Welcome to In the Room with me, Ronnie Barber. In this series, we'll be talking to politicians, YouTubers, sports stars, and scientists about the defining moments of their lives. From the classroom to the boardroom, the briefing room, the dressing room, and a whole lot more, we'll find out how the rooms of our lives shape the decisions we make. This week in the room, I'm talking to Professor Dame Elizabeth Anionwu, a nursing pioneer whose work on sickle cell disease has helped thousands upon thousands of people lead better lives. We'll hear how her life began in care and how that led to her passion for nursing.
And then when I found out she was not only a nun, but she was also something called a nurse, I vowed that's what I would become.
How she thinks COVID-19 has been a wake-up call for equality in the NHS.
If COVID-19 hasn't been a wretched wake-up call for the National Health Service to really properly value all its NHS staff, that's what we're wanting, is respect.
And we'll hear her advice to anyone thinking of pursuing a career in nursing.
Find out an area that really makes you excited, that you really want to learn more about, you want to specialise in that area.
The first room I put Dame Elizabeth in was in a school in Wolverhampton, where she began her career as a nursing assistant.
Yes, she was a nun in Nazareth House Convent in Birmingham, where I was. I was there until the age of 9, and I had very bad eczema. And I used to peep round the sick bay door when I went for my regular change of dressing to see whether the, inverted commas, white nun was there. All the nuns were white. They were mainly Irish. But this particular nun wore a white habit instead of a black, the traditional black habit that nuns wore. And I loved her to bits because I knew I wasn't going to have any pain when she changed my dressing, because she used, I think, what we would call distraction therapy now. I have to remember, I was brought up in this very strict Catholic environment, and we were taught that nuns were the wives of Christ, the brides of Christ, and they were very, very holy women. And, you as children, you take on a lot of this sort of, would we dare call it propaganda? I don't know. But anyway, I just adored this nun because she would use words that I wouldn't expect her to use. Bottom. To me, this was like a swear word. And she would get me every time. I would burst out laughing. The next thing I know, the dressing is off. I haven't felt a thing. And I even now I can remember that feeling of trust, I think you would call it, and joy. I never realised that what could be a painful dressing could turn out to be a joyous occasion. Mm-hmm. And then when I found out she was not only a nun, but she was also something called a nurse, I vowed that's what I would become. And that's exactly what happened.
Your book, Mixed Blessings from a Cambridge Union. Let's talk about your mum and dad. Your mum was Irish, your dad was Nigerian, both studying at Cambridge University. Interesting times. They had an affair, and you were the blessing that came from that. What was it like then for your mum, and how did that develop, the relationship between your mum and dad? Did they go their separate ways after you were born?
Not straight away. I don't have a huge amount of information, but when I wanted to do research for my memoirs, I contacted Nazareth House Archives. Actually, only, it wasn't for research, it was to see if they had any photographs. To cut a long story short, they didn't have any photographs, but they presented me with this dossier of records about me, which was a gold mine of information. And that's how I discovered that, well, one of the things I discovered was that my parents were actually engaged. Now, my mother never told me this. I know it's because it must have been such a traumatic period of her life that she couldn't bring herself to tell me too much. All she told me in a few letters when I wrote and asked her about my father as an adult, when she told me that it didn't, the affair, if you like, didn't turn out the way she had hoped. My father had was older than her and had completed his law degree at Cambridge University and then went down to London to become a barrister. And after he was called to the bar, he went back to Nigeria. This is, of course, pre-independence Nigeria. 1949, he went back. I would have been two, coming up for two. I also had heard from my mother that he had visited me in the children's home, and I saw the correspondence between my mother and the Catholic I think he was the bishop in charge of all these issues, where she was asking permission for my father to come and visit me. You know, I'm a feisty woman of 73 years of age. So I was nearly 70 when I came across this correspondence, and I thought, what? Mm. You have to ask permission to, but of course this, we have to, you know, I had to remember this was, actually this would have been just after the Second World War. The mores of society were so different then, the hierarchy, the sort of, my mother was getting a huge amount of support from the Catholic Church. I really have to stress that. Unlike the tragic narrative of Philomena that many of us know, the novel, well, it's not a novel, the details about Philomena's life. So my mother was very, very respectful. I can see this in the correspondence between her and the church. And so, you know, it was a sort of a mixture. My life's always been a mixture of happiness and sadness. Well, I suppose that's everybody, but in a sense, I was very happy in the children's home, and yet I wanted a normal family home. I love reading, absolutely adore reading from early years. And so I would read, I don't know whether it was the Janet and John books, come on, you know, very middle-class white parents and the coziness of the home, you know, yeah. I wanted that. And yet I loved aspects of my convent upbringing, the Irish dancing and going for a Knickerbocker glory when I'd done piano practice. Okay. I think some of the nuns spoilt me. And I think that's why I have a much higher degree of happiness in my memories of that era than other children possibly.
A black girl raised in a white world is one of the phrases that is coming out as well. Were you aware of racism at that young age? Did you feel any sense of it at all, Elizabeth?
I must have done, because the stark memory I have, again ending up in sick bay as a result, was washing my face 10 times with something like red Lifebuoy soap, harsh soap anyway, because the skin started peeling and I ended up in sick bay. I don't think anybody asked me why I was washing my face that many times. It was to become white like my friends. I knew I was different. Occasionally it was pointed out in quite cruel way. I was supposed to play Humpty Dumpty in a little drama that one of the nuns had organised, and another nun said, no, she can't. She's half caste. Of course, that was the term that I grew up as describing somebody like myself, mixed race, black and white. And I remember bawling my little head off, you know, how unfair life was. I obviously was a bit of a show off. I wanted to be Humpty Dumpty. I wanted to fall off that wall. And why was this horrible nun? And then suddenly I realized this other nun was batting for me, if you like. She was arguing with the nun. I'd never, ever seen nuns argue before. And that showed me this was interesting. And although I was crying, I was smiling inside thinking, these two nuns are arguing about me. And the best thing, I got to play Humpty Dumpty. So it's such a mixture of emotions that I can look back on. A sense of injustice, a sense of being different, other. And it being called out that I was different colour. Yes, yes.
Moving forward, because you say there the inspiration to become a nurse, and you vowed to become a nurse from that wonderful nun that looked after you. You strike me, certainly from the book, you strike me as somebody who, once you've decided you're going to do something or you're going to focus on something, you do it. So you become a nurse and you study, and sickle cell becomes the main driving force, really, and correct me if I'm wrong, Elizabeth, but of your nursing world. You want to talk about, you want to do something about sickle cell. Tell us a wee bit more about sickle cell and why that became a focus for you.
I certainly am a very obstinate person. I like to think I'm less obstinate, but I'm not sure that that's the case. I don't like injustice, and I had further experiences of racism as I was growing up. And so I was a health visitor in Brent in the early, I think it was 1970, 71. We have to remember that the impact of the American civil rights movement, and I was reading a lot, as I said, and I'd also spent 9 months in Paris working, but I'd become politicized with a small p. And it was, I knew I wanted to find my father. I didn't do anything about it initially. It was when I was a health visitor, one of the families that I visited, the mother had a son with sickle cell anemia, which is an inherited red blood cell disorder that mainly affects people of origins in the tropics. It's actually linked to malaria, one of the malarias. And so in this country, you see significant number of black individuals affected by the condition. Now, this young lad, I think he was about 9, was lying on the couch, moaning. He was in pain, but not in the severe pain that I later came to realize about the condition. I think he'd been discharged from hospital. The mother was quite happy, actually, about his medical treatment, but she was so thirsty for knowledge about the illness itself. What could she do to help her son? What could she do to stop him getting these painful crises? I'd not had a lecture about the illness in my nurse education program, nor my health visiting program. And therefore, I didn't know what to say to this mother. So I had, again, it's this mixture of things that constantly reminds me of nothing is black and white, exactly. So on the one hand, I was furious that with myself that I didn't know anything, shamed that I couldn't support this mother, whereas I could have done if it was another condition, like epilepsy, or which we had been taught about, for example. And I was really angry, which obviously I couldn't show the mother. So I vowed that I would find out more about this condition. That was one of the drives for me. Another was I had met my father around this time, maybe 6 months or so later. And I discovered that I had a cousin with sickle cell anemia. Now, he lived into his 60s, thank goodness. And then the other was political, with a small p. I wanted to get involved with black community health issues. Well, this landed on my plate, sickle cell, because I checked out with my fellow health visitors and my nursing friends, and most of us had not received a lecture on sickle cell anemia. And you know something, I even went back to my medical nursing textbook. It was published in 1965. I did my nurse education program in 65 to 68 in Paddington, West London. Well, anybody that's watching the Small Axe series of Steve McQueen will know that was a significant black community in London in that era. Why was I never taught about sickle cell anemia? And I think the penny started to drop, you know, that, hold on, this is to do with race. This is to do with a hierarchy of illnesses, whether we like it or not, that a condition that mainly affects black individuals is not even taught about in nursing schools. That I cannot tell you how angry that made me.
You mentioned your father. Let's move into the next room. I don't know where this meeting room would be. I'm putting in the meeting room, but you accidentally discover where your father is. Take me to that meeting room and tell me the story about how you discovered he was an ambassador for Nigeria in Italy and for the Vatican. Tell me what led to that moment of you being in the meeting room with your father at the age of 20, you were 25 when you caught up with him again.
It's again the early 1970s, And I now wanted to know about my father. I wrote to my mother and she immediately wrote back, because you have to remember, the stigma of my illegitimacy, my mixed race, my mother never married, obviously, my father anyway, and I had her maiden name. I was called Elizabeth Furlong. It was an Irish surname. And so I wrote to my mother and said, tell me about my father. She immediately did this and said, his name is Lawrence Odiatu Victor Anion. The law degree, he went back to Nigeria. We've lost contact. I'm not sure you'll find him. It was before the internet. I'm not sure it's a good idea that you should look for him, because she was worried that I might be rejected by his family. I didn't do anything with the name for 3 months because I didn't know any Nigerians. But I then realised I knew a barrister from Sierra Leone, the late John Roberts QC. And John said, look, Elizabeth, he had once told me he taught Nigerian law students. I thought, John's the guy. And all I wanted from John was, what part of Nigeria did my father's name come from? Because this was not that long after the dreadful Nigerian civil war, the Biafran war. So I knew there were different ethnic groups. He said, I'm not sure, Elizabeth. It was Monday evening. Wednesday morning, he rang me at the clinic. I've spoken to your father. Well, every time I tell that story, I often think, why is it I still get the same feeling when I tell that story? And it really shows what an impact it must have made. I was in my clinic. I just froze. I couldn't believe it. I said, because when I said he'd spoken to my father, I said, what, in Nigeria? He said, no, he's in Palmer's Green, North London. And he wants you to talk. He wants to speak to you. This is his number. Please ring him now. And I'm glad I was sort of directed a little bit like that, because I think if I had taken a minute to think, well, should I? I got that horrible feeling you get in your stomach when you're frightened, but you're excited at the same time. So I dropped the phone on John and I immediately picked the phone up and rang my father. And his warm, deep voice greeted me at the other end. Welcome. He told me, anyway, I cannot remember much of that phone call, except he said, you will come and see me tomorrow evening. I thought, oh, really? You know, and the sort of, would it be the feminist in me? I have no idea. Let's just say the feisty woman in me partly thought, okay, I never like being told what to do. But I didn't take it that way. It made me laugh in a way. I didn't laugh, you know. I thought, okay. And I did. I went to see him. So actually, the room, you have to envisage me riding my mobilette scooter on the North Circular, nearly getting killed because I was distracted thinking about, I wonder what my father's going to look like. And suddenly, hoot, 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 hoot. And I slithered into another lane, so I nearly never got to see my father. That woke me up for sure, and I concentrated, parked the scooter outside. The nerves really didn't, I was actually feeling a bit sick with nerves, because what was this man going to be like? I could get on with it. And you did mention I get on with things. So just get on with it, Elizabeth. Went up, took a deep breath, pressed the doorbell, petrified. And again, it's like in slow motion, the door opens, and this very dark, short, big, well-built man opened the door. And it was like mini-me. He just looked like me. Obviously, he was darker in the face. And he said, welcome. And then I thought he said no. Later on, I learned it. He's Igbo. No is welcome in Igbo. And he gave me this most enormous hug. And I was crying and smiling at the same time. And I looked up and my stepmother was standing looking at me and said, come on, come in. And so the room I remember is the front door and then going into the living room of his house. Unbelievable, unbelievable experience.
Was he the first person to give you proper career advice?
He was, because my father went back to Nigeria in November of that year, and I made my first visit to Nigeria in the summer of 1973. I was now 26. I just fell in love with the country. I loved the heat. The food was wonderful. Most importantly was the incredible welcome I had from my family and thousands, it seemed, relatives, the extended family. And I just felt accepted. That's not to say my mother's family never accepted me. But one thing I did notice there was a difference in Nigeria was I didn't get this sense of stigma due to illegitimacy. You know, the sentence I heard a lot was, you are your father's daughter. I mean, they would say this in Igbo. I sort of gradually learned what that was. And and occasionally if I showed my hesitancy about being a member of the family, using my father's surname, for example, there's this abruptness in the Igbo people sometimes. I initially, ooh, and then I come to love it now, you know. A bit like the Yorkshire folk, I think, you know, what you see is what you get. What is your problem? You are your father's daughter. Oh, okay, I get it. So I wanted to go and work there. And then my father sat me down, overjoyed at my acceptance of the family and joy at being in Nigeria. But he said, look, Elizabeth, you know, I don't think you will cope very well at your level. I think if you could become over here at a much more senior level, how could you achieve that? And he literally sat me down and said, how can you progress in your career? Nobody had ever asked me that before. Now, today, that's not the case. There's so much career counselling in nursing and midwifery, you know, which is wonderful, but not in those days. You were left to yourself a little bit, unless there were people who maybe saw something. I don't know, but you became a nurse and then you did midwifery, even though that means you studied midwifery, even though you didn't want to practice it. So my father said, look, is there any way you can come at a more senior level? How can you progress? So I remember sitting there saying, well, in nursing, you do clinical, maybe award system, you could become a manager. Ugh, that's not what I wanted. I didn't want to work in hospitals and be go that route, clinical in those days. But you could also go into education. And I think he even saw my eyes lit up there. You know, I loved teaching as a health visitor. And he said, well, I said, you could become a tutor. So he said, well, become a tutor. I said, Dad, you know, I think I'm a bit young. He said, well, are you saying you couldn't apply to become a tutor to do the course? I said, well, I don't know. He said, So what are you waiting for? Basically, get on with it. And I've not come across this sort of, you want to get from A to Z, you go via this route, get on with it. And it's what I needed, and I reacted very positively to that. And to cut a long story short, I didn't end up working in Nigeria, although I visited it quite a lot. I only knew my father for 8 years as he died quite young. But I ended up in nurse education and, actually in sickle cell and then nurse education. So it was interesting that I can pinpoint my career development to my father.
From the nun to your father, it's a lovely word. Let me take you. This is a wee bit self-indulgent for me. I want to put you back in the ward. Today we're talking on the very first vaccinations done for the pandemic. A lovely lady called Margaret Besson, I think her name was, she got her a vaccination from a Filipino nurse, May Parsons.
That sent a shiver down my spine.
It was, my wife's a nurse, and the both of us sat there and went, this is the NHS. This is, it's fantastic. Your passion has always been for nursing and sickle cell and everything, but I want to put you back in the ward. I want you to talk to me about nurses from overseas and how they are the backbone of the NHS, and how, I just want to pick your brains about how you would see the NHS developing from a nursing aspect mainly, but, you know, if you want to talk about the NHS in general on the day, and, you know, we've got the vaccination just beginning to be rolled out, but we've seen 9 months sheer hell for the nursing and the medical world. What have you been thinking when you've been watching this, and what do you think about the future of nursing post-pandemic?
Well, first of all, I would hope that that Filipino nurse has already had her vaccine. Now, would the NHS have learnt that lesson? Would the NHS have learnt that lesson? Absolutely. Of course, the priority is our elders. Yes, the priorities. Are we prioritising? I know the NHS staff are going, has that Filipino nurse also had her vaccine before she administered the vaccine? In the caring way I know she would have done to that 80-year-old, 80-plus lady. That, in a nutshell, is what I want the NHS to be, is to be, get themselves, you know, there isn't the talk, put yourself in the shoes of others. So immediately, whilst I am as excited as everybody else, I love science, and it is absolutely wonderful that this vaccine is there. And at a global level, I'm already, like others, hoping there's going to be an equitable distribution of this vaccine, both in this country, which I think, you know, everybody is trying to do, to be fair. But again, did that Filipino nurse get her vaccine? but globally, you want to see that there's... And I know I'm a bit naive in like some of us, we want equality. That's what I want in the National Health Service. If COVID-19 hasn't been a wretched wake-up call for the National Health Service to really properly value all its NHS staff, that's what we're wanting, is respect and caring for our NHS staff, and that we shouldn't be having these conversations. That the NHS should also particularly make sure that some sections of their workforce, as they would call it, their staff, have been less favourably treated than others. But that is the reality. So, of course, that's something I would want absolutely removed from the NHS, that we all start at the same point and according to our abilities and opportunities, we progress if we wish to progress. That's what I want to see.
Because the tragic irony really is that we found that during the pandemic, I follow several nursing websites, and barely during the peak of it, Black and ethnic minority nurses were particularly affected by COVID. And your heart breaks because they're frontline and they're putting themselves up there. And that, what you're saying there about the equality aspect, and I don't know if that's actually ever going to be achieved, because you're an optimist. Your book is just about optimism. Do you think the kind of equitable rollout of things like the pandemic and the treatment of nurses from overseas, it's got better? Will it ever be totally equal, do you think, just taking the NHS?
I know I come over as an optimist, but I'm also quite realistic as well. And that, unfortunately, I don't see racism ever disappearing. I don't see different priorities in who is seen to be more important than others is actually going to disappear. However, we have seen in certain eras that I've come through, periods when it's made clear that you can be as racist as you like at home, but in this work situation, it is unacceptable. And, you know, you get the warnings, whatever, you get the disciplinary, or if it's absolutely outrageous, you are sacked. And that's the harsh side of me that maybe, you know, doesn't come through straight away. The organisation has an absolute responsibility, whether that is at a ward level, in the community. I'm talking about the NHS arena now, in the chief exec's office, the chief nursing office, the whole, what responsibilities has each level got, and where is the accountability to ensure that this message is so clear, it's not ambiguous. We can't look over our shoulder and think, hold on, I can get away with it because last week I saw that person get away with it. No, we need that clear line of accountability. And we need people to be valued when they are being equitable. You know, we talk about valuing people. We need to, it's like when you're trying to bring children up. If they behave well, you should congratulate them. I don't say congratulate them for them, but make it clear to them that you're actually very happy with them, because most children really are seeking approval from their parents. NHS staff are seeking approval from whoever is their manager, as well as seeking respect, whether that's in their pay packet or the way that they're treated. So this line of accountability is up and it's down. And it seems to me that the messages are there sometimes and then they disappear. If COVID-19 doesn't sort us out, I don't know what else is going to sort us out. If a tragedy like COVID-19, I go on about the Filipino nurse getting that vaccine, because we know that Filipino nurses, as with African nurses, as with Caribbean nurses, Black heritage nurses and others, had actually died. Well, the viral overload of them, whether it was they were not being given proper protective equipment, clothing to stop. You know, one and one should have been put together, that these are individuals who are on the front line. COVID-19 should have been treated like a war. You know, when the soldiers are sent on the front line, have they got their military gear to at least protect them with the technology and the resources that we've got, the knowledge that we've got? You know, all this, and sorry, this is where I get angry. We're the best in the world. Oh, come on. Stop being so competitive. Start looking at what's going on in this country. People will really respect that. Where has this wretched global competitiveness come from? Stop it. Look after your NHS staff. Sorry, yeah, you've got me on there, you see?
Yeah, well,
so the nice Elizabeth, it's crept through that she can be quite angry
at
times.
I can see that. I don't think it's a small P political. I think that's a big P, and I'm pleased to hear you putting it. Last one for you, Elizabeth. You're in charge of the ward. You're still in charge. I've put you in charge of the ward. And you see this young nurse coming in from the far end. She's just coming onto her ward for the first day. Her name's Elizabeth, right? What are you going to tell that young Elizabeth as she enters the nursing world? What kind of things will she experience, and what joy, frustrations will she get from being a nurse?
I would have a discussion and share with her what helped me along the way, which has been, remember what brought you into nursing. If you came into nursing to care for people, to make them feel better, to get better, whatever reason, maybe you had a relative that was sick and you saw something about the care of that family that you admired, cling on to that throughout your career. Just remember that. Secondly, study. You know, the studying helped me enormously understand why we did this, why this makes us the patient more comfortable. Just study. Find out an area that really makes you excited, that you really want to learn more about, you want to specialise in that area, possibly. If you haven't thought about it, perhaps that's the area you should specialise in, because nursing is really hard work, as is many careers in the NHS. But there are lows and there are highs. The highs give you the energy to drive you through when you're feeling down. And what provided me with the highs was working in an area that I really was fascinated by. It happened to be sickle cell. I've seen the improvements over the years, but there's still more to come. And the relationship that you develop with individuals with the condition, it is an equal relationship, because you learn very quickly that on the whole, most patients, particularly with long-term conditions, know a heck of a lot more than you do, but that you can provide them with support and care that they cannot organise on their own. So that I think is, and also I would tell a nurse, if you feel you've actually come into the wrong profession, you know, have the confidence to realise it's not for you and look for a different profession that you'd be more at ease with. And so, you know, we don't want the wrong people in this profession, the uncaring. We don't want them. So those are some of the things. And finally, for me anyway, it was the best decision I ever made.
Mm-hmm. It was probably the only decision you could have made from that. And I think, you know, when I was reading your book, I just was, you know, they talk about vocational work. And as I said to you before, my wife's a nurse, and I just feel that she's always been a nurse. She's always had that's always been her driving force to look after people and the different sort of spheres that she's worked in. And that from that one caring person who you discovered was a nurse to you now and the work you've done, and you become a dame and everything, and you're recognised, it's such a fantastic journey.
And my mother would have been, well, my mother was very proud because she died in 2003. And hot off the press, my memoirs have been taken up by a publisher. And yes, isn't that, because I self-published it, you know.
Yes, yes.
And Orion Publishers have taken it up. It'll be out in June next year. And it's got a new title. And guess what that title is? Dreams from My Mother.
A massive thank you to Dame Elizabeth Anionwu. Next week, I'll be talking to Ian Dale, the LBC presenter, podcaster, publisher and writer.
Just in our everyday life, I think we've lost the ability to understand that the other person not only has another different point of view, but is entitled to a different point of view.
See you next time in The Room.